KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
An immigration judge in Louisiana rules on the fate of a Columbia University graduate student who led protests on campus last year.
He was arrested by federal agents last month.
We will bring you the latest this Friday, April 11th, on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. More people are being asked by Border Protection agents to hand over their phones.
We'll offer some tips on how to prepare if you are a U.S. citizen.
Because citizens have an absolute right to re-enter the country, they have a bit more leverage to deny a request or refuse to comply.
Also, a new study shows crows can recognize geometric shapes. This is a big deal because
there was no single animal that demonstrated this capability of detecting geometric regularity.
And a small art center in San Francisco's Chinatown tries to figure out its future amid federal funding cuts.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump says five more law firms have reached deals with him to avert the threat of punishing executive orders. In return, the firms have agreed to provide hundreds of millions of dollars in pro bono legal work on causes Trump supports. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
The five firms are some of the most prominent big law firms in the U.S., including Kirkland & Ellis and Latham & Watkins. Trump says they have all together agreed to provide more than $500 million in free legal work on issues that he and the firm support. The latest agreements bring the total number of law firms to reach a deal with Trump to nine. Three other firms targeted by Trump have opted instead to fight the executive orders. Those firms have sued, and in all three instances, federal judges have said Trump's actions are likely unconstitutional, and they have temporarily blocked enforcement of his punitive actions. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Texas Department of State Health Services has confirmed 36 new cases of measles since Tuesday. As Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Alcorta-Solario reports, it brings the total number of confirmed cases to 541 since the outbreak began late January.
The measles cases in West Texas are not slowing down. Since the outbreak began, 56 patients have been hospitalized. Two school-age children have died due to complications from the virus. Both were unvaccinated and lived in the area of the outbreak. A person in New Mexico who died in early March lived in the county that borders the region where the outbreak is centered. Just seven of the cases occurred in people who have received two doses of the MMR vaccine and four in those who received one dose. The rest are unvaccinated or their status is unknown. I'm Gabriela Alcorta-Solorio in San Antonio.
Federal judge in Maryland took members of the Trump administration to task during a hearing today, accusing Justice Department of lawyers of being unprepared to explain what, if anything, the administration is doing to arrange the return of the man mistakenly sent to El Salvador last month. Government appearing to struggle to provide any information about the whereabouts of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, even though the Supreme Court earlier this week said the administration must facilitate his return. President Trump's trade war is taking a toll on consumer sentiment. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Consumer sentiment fell in April for the fourth month in a row and has now dropped by 30% since the end of last year. People across the political spectrum are less optimistic about business conditions, personal finances, and inflation. More than twice as many people are worried about the job market now as were back in November. Concerns about rising unemployment are the highest they've been since 2009, when the economy was shedding hundreds of thousands of jobs every month. The survey was conducted around the time President Trump announced sweeping tariffs on imports from around the world. It does not account for his partial backtracking earlier this week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. A family from Spain was celebrating one of their children's ninth birthday with a helicopter tour in the skies above New York City when something went terribly wrong. All five members of the family, along with the chopper's pilot, dying after the rotors appeared to become detached, resulting in the aircraft plunging into the Hudson River. Officials have identified the victims as Siemens executive Agustin Escobar, his wife Merce Camrubo Montal, and their three children. The pilot was 36-year-old Sean Keese Johnson. Crash is being investigated by the National Transportation Safety Board. Climate change is making for longer and more intense pollen seasons. That means more severe symptoms for those with allergies. That's according to a new paper from researchers at George Washington University's School of Medicine. Bureau's Maria Godoy has the story.
The researchers reviewed dozens of studies looking at the impact of climate change on seasonal allergies around the globe. Lead author Alicia Pershad says with rising global temperatures, pollen seasons are lengthening.
So they are starting earlier and ending later.
For example, one study found the pollen season had already gotten 20 days longer in North America between 1990 and 2018. Several studies also found an increase in the average daily concentration of pollen, all of which means more misery for those with pollen allergies.
They're having more symptoms, earlier symptoms, and worse symptoms.
The paper appears in the journal The Laryngoscope. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Stocks gain ground to end the week on Wall Street. The Dow is up 619 points. The Nasdaq rose 337 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Mahmoud Khalil can be deported. That was the decision that a federal immigration judge made in a small courtroom in Jena, Louisiana today. Khalil is the Columbia University graduate student who has gained global attention since the U.S. government arrested him last month over his pro-Palestinian activism. NPR's Adrian Florido joins us now from just outside the courtroom. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what evidence did the judge base her decision on here?
Well, the central piece of evidence was a short, undated, two-page memo from Secretary of State Marco Rubio. In it, Rubio said that on March 7th, he got information about Khalil from the Department of Homeland Security, and as a result, he had determined that Khalil had engaged in, quote, anti-Semitic protests. Khalil was arrested by ICE agents the next day. There's a rarely used section of a federal law that allows the Secretary of State to order someone's deportation if he believes that their presence in the country would, quote, compromise a compelling U.S. foreign policy interest. And in his memo, Rubio said that condoning what he called Khalil's anti-Semitic conduct would undermine the U.S. foreign policy goal of combating anti-Semitism around the world.
Wait, these accusations of anti-Semitism, I mean, how did Khalil's lawyers respond to those accusations?
Well, Khalil's lawyer, Mark Vanderhoot, said in court today that the accusation that Khalil is anti-Semitic is baseless. He said the government provided no further explanation about how Marco Rubio decided that Khalil's protest activity was anti-Semitic. He said Khalil's protests were not against Jews. In fact, he often spoke about the importance of having Jews in the movement for Palestinian rights. He asked the judge to allow him to question Rubio in court. But Judge Jamie Comins rejected that request. She said that because that statute gives the Secretary of State unilateral authority to decide if someone threatens U.S. foreign policy interests, that she has no authority to question his decision. So she said that she therefore had to rule that Khalil can be deported.
Wow. So what does this mean ultimately for Khalil?
He's not going to be immediately deported. The judge gave his lawyers until April 23rd to apply for a stay if they think he qualifies for one. His lawyers have also said they're going to appeal, and they're challenging the constitutionality of his arrest in federal court in New Jersey. His lawyer, Mark Vanderhoot, called today's ruling, quote, a weaponization of immigration law to suppress dissent, and he said that this is not over. For now, Khalil will remain at this remote Louisiana detention center where he's been for a month.
Mm. And I understand, Adrian, that you were sitting behind Mahmoud Khalil as he was listening to the judge's ruling today. What was his reaction like?
He didn't have a visible reaction when she ruled, but after she adjourned the hearing, he asked if he could address the court. She allowed him to, and he said that he had been afforded neither the principles of due process nor fundamental fairness in that courtroom. Quote, this is exactly why the Trump administration has sent me to this court 1,000 miles away from my family, he said. As the 22 observers and journalists in the courtroom filed out, he turned around, he smiled at us, and he used his hands to form the shape of a heart.
Do you think this case could find its way to the Supreme Court?
It could. The case could answer some really crucial questions about how far the government can go to deport non-citizens for their political activity. The First Amendment protects everyone in the U.S. in theory. In reality, there's still a lot of legal gray area when it comes to non-citizens. The administration is moving fast to deport non-citizens. Civil rights lawyers are trying to stop it.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Gina, Louisiana. Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks, Elsa.
When the stock market drops, investors typically sell stocks and buy bonds. Bonds are assets that are perceived as safer with lower risk, and the safest of those are usually bonds issued by the U.S. government known as treasuries. But that is not what happened this past week. NPR's Mary Childs from the Planet Money podcast joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Mary, it was a wild week. Tell us what happened.
It was very wild. So earlier this week, when the biggest tariffs were still on and it looked like Trump was not going to back down, investors were selling U.S. stocks aggressively, but they were also selling treasuries. Prices on treasuries dropped too. And some of the moves in the 30-year bond were the biggest since the 1980s. And as you said, it's really unusual to see both markets selling off like this. They're supposed to move in opposite directions. So this is a sign that something big might be changing.
Well, the fact that this is happening, what could that mean?
It might mean that investors are starting to see U.S. treasuries as not the safe thing to flee to. So this action in the market suggests that investors are suddenly scared not just of risk, which you can see from them fleeing stocks, but that they're actually scared of U.S. assets in general. They seem to be fleeing U.S. financial markets more broadly. And you can tell because of how bond markets work and how government bond markets work. Investors demand more compensation and interest payments for more perceived risk. So typically, governments of economies that are seen as more safe and stable get charged a lower interest rate when they sell bonds compared to what developing economies have to offer investors. But all of a sudden, the market is not treating the U.S. like a developed economy as much anymore. And actually, the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers tweeted about this phenomenon, saying, quote, "We are being treated by global financial markets like a problematic emerging market."
I mean, I gotta ask, is there something to what he's saying there?
It is sort of surprising. Yes, right now, you know, Greece, Italy, Czechia have lower yields on their 10-year bonds than the U.S. does. I mean, we're still a ways away from the 10%+ yields for countries like Colombia or South Africa. So still some context there.
Okay, help us understand why this matters. What does this particular market mean practically for the government as well as the economy?
So higher yields are generally bad for governments because issuing bonds at higher rates means those bonds are just more expensive. They're going to cost more in interest payments. And, you know, a government would prefer to use its money providing services to its citizens instead of just making interest payments to bondholders. And higher rates translate through the economy to higher mortgage rates for would-be home buyers in the U.S. and for companies who borrow money to fund themselves. And that's actually why this market puts more pressure on the government to change direction than, say, just a stock market drop. Because there's this old saying that everyone has been citing from James Carville back in the Clinton administration, that if there's reincarnation, he wants to come back as the bond market because the bond market can intimidate everybody. And that is still true.
Is it all bad news for the U.S. bond market? How definitive is it that we're headed in this direction?
Thankfully, the market signals are not totally directional. It's a little bit mixed. So the U.S. Treasury held three important auctions of government bonds this week. One on Tuesday, which did not go great, pretty tepid demand seen there. But the ones on Wednesday and Thursday both went better than expected. On Wednesday, the auction was kind of shockingly successful. Markets were still freaking out about these tariffs, and the auction saw more demand than expected for U.S. government bonds, which is great news. And then on Thursday, it was pretty good demand, not as strong, but still good. So that's, you know, it's not all going in the negative direction, but the longer term trend is not looking great because for the past 3 months, investors abroad have been selling their holdings of longer term treasuries as central banks around the world seek to diversify away from the United States.
NPR's Mary Childs is a co-host of the Planet Money podcast. Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
Squares, triangles, circles. These geometric shapes appear everywhere in art and architecture, going back all through human history. Geometric regularity seems to be something that the human brain is primed to recognize. But what about the brains of other animals? Well, NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports that scientists recently gave a geometry test to crows.
Crows are pretty smart. They can make simple tools. And at the University of Tübingen in Germany, there's a lab where crows learn to play computer games. It's the lab of cognitive scientist Andreas Nieder. He says the games are designed to tease out what crows know about math. In one study, for example, a computer screen showed crows a certain number of dots, and the crows had to count them by pecking.
They can see three dots and then produce three pecks, and then press an enter key, sort of, in order to tell us that they're done with the counting sequence.
It turns out the skills of counting crows rival those of toddlers. Recently, Nieder wondered what the crows knew about geometry. Could the crows distinguish regular shapes like squares or parallelograms from irregular quadrilaterals? So he had a couple crows learn a new game. The birds would see six shapes on the screen, and they'd have to pick the one shape that was different.
And initially, we presented some very obviously different figures, say, for instance, five moons and one flower.
If the crows pecked on the flower, they'd get a treat, like yummy mealworms. Once the birds knew the drill, find the thing that's different, the researchers started testing them with geometric shapes, showing them, say, five perfect squares, along with another four-sided figure that was just a little off.
And asked them whether they, with these quadrilaterals, they could still continue to find the outlier, even though the outlier was looking perceptually very similar to the other five regular shapes.
Turns out the crows could. In the journal Science Advances, the researchers describe a series of tests showing that crows clearly had a sense of right angles, parallel lines, symmetry. And that's a big deal, because Nieder says before this,
there was no single animal that demonstrated this capability of detecting geometric regularity.
There was one recent study that looked to see if a non-human primate could do it, baboons, but no dice. Nieder says it's not really clear why the baboons couldn't. Maybe in other situations they or other monkeys would be able to. But what's important is that clearly humans' predilection for geometry didn't come out of nowhere. It's out there in the animal kingdom.
Because we have at least the crow. And again, I would never dare to say that this is the only species. It's just now opening up this field of investigation.
The study impressed Matthias Sabelmeier. He's a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of College London and is one of the researchers who previously tested baboons.
Baboons are so much closer to us, and we train them so much more.
So he was surprised that unlike baboons, crows were able to show off a sense of geometry.
I have to accept the result and think, you know, that's pretty cool. And then the question is, where does that even come from?
He's looking forward to more studies in crows and other creatures. Unlike other mathematical abilities like counting or understanding the concept of zero, intuition about geometry just hasn't been tested much in animals. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Amir Makhled is a Michigan-based attorney and a U.S. citizen who was recently detained by federal agents while returning home from a family vacation. They asked him to hand over his cell phone. He refused, but he did eventually agree to let them see his contacts. When we spoke to Makhled earlier this week, he told us that he suspects he was singled out because one of his clients is a pro-Palestinian campus protester.
It's setting a terrifying precedent. If government agents can target a lawyer at the border, what's stopping them from doing it to anyone who dares to speak out?
I will note that Customs and Border Protection has not returned NPR's request for comment, but the agency has disputed Makhled's reasoning for his detention. We wanted to know more about what the rights of U.S. citizens are in situations like these, so we called up Sophia Cope. She's a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit that focuses on digital civil liberties. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Okay, so just to start us off, can U.S. citizens refuse these sorts of requests, like hand over your cell phone, show us your contacts, when they're at the border?
Yeah, so because citizens have an absolute right to re-enter the country, they have a bit more leverage to, you know, deny a request or refuse to comply mm-hmm. with requests to unlock their phone, but that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be consequences. They could be detained for several hours, their phone could eventually be confiscated, so even U.S. citizens have to think about those potential consequences.
The trade-offs. Okay, well, what about lawful permanent residents? How much leeway do they have to potentially refuse?
Yeah, technically they also have to be let back into the country, but as we've seen in sort of a non-border context, the government and the current administration is pretty willing to question the status of LPRs. And so we always say that, you know, they should be especially kind of mindful and thoughtful about how they comport themselves at the border.
So if you are someone who is concerned about having your phone searched at the border, what should you do to prepare?
Yeah, so what we say to people is, first, you must have a plan before you travel. You don't want to be in the line to present yourself before the border officer and then start thinking about what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, one size doesn't fit all. We urge people to think about lots of different what we call risk assessment factors that go to the likelihood that you're going to be pulled into secondary inspection, okay. and then ultimately how you prepare your devices and your data for that.
Talk about some of those risk factors. What kinds of factors would make someone more susceptible to being searched?
Travel history is a big one. You know, if you've been traveling to areas of the world that maybe are known for terrorism or drug trafficking or child sex tourism, that can be a red flag for CBP officers. Obviously, if you have prior law enforcement history, that could be potentially flagged in your travel profile. Other things that we urge people to think about is really the sensitivity of your data. If you are, let's say, a journalist that has confidential source information, a doctor or an attorney, where you have particular ethical obligations to protect data, then you should really think about not having that data on your device. Most important is to back up your data, because if your device is seized or the data is corrupted during the search, then you're going to be out of luck. So you want to make sure that you have a backup of that data.
What about encrypting some data on your phone?
We definitely urge people to always, regardless of whether they're crossing the border, have strong passcodes and have strong encryption on their devices. The current iPhone, for example, if you have it, you know, passcode protected, that automatically engages encryption, but that is sort of irrelevant if you've decided that it's in your best interest to comply with a request to unlock your device or give over your passcode.
That is Sophia Cope, senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
It's not unusual for high schools to put on musical productions, but to get an extended run, packed shows, and an invitation to perform on their city's biggest stage, well, that is exactly what happened earlier this year to one Anchorage High School's production of Hadestown. Though, as Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports, the future of the theater program is uncertain.
Way down, Hadestown, way down under the ground.
Hadestown is a hit musical that retells the Greek myth of Eurydice and Orpheus. The story follows the doomed lovers down into an underworld controlled by the god of the dead, Hades.
Everyone is trying to get a ticket to go, but those who go, they don't come back.
And from the first night it was performed by these students at West High School back in February, the show's director knew that this version was special.
As the curtain raised at the end of the show, the audience leapt to their feet. Standing ovation on an opening night is kind of rare, but we got that.
Brian Like teaches English and theater at West High and directed the play. He says the energy of this group just jumped off the stage and the audience responded. The first performance drew about 150 people, but a couple days later, that number had more than doubled. The production got an extended run, and at the final school performance a couple weeks later, more than 1,200 people filled the high school auditorium.
We had so many instances of people showing up Thursday night, coming back Friday night, coming to the Saturday matinee.
Azra Brand plays Hermes, the narrator. She says, as an actor, the energy of the crowds has been amazing.
It was really fun as like our community to be like, yeah, we are appreciated and we're so big in Anchorage. I still like pinch myself every once in a while.
Eurydice is played by Adela Judge. She says by the end, the production was so seamless, she and her castmates felt like professionals.
It was like this surreal experience. Like I felt like I was on an actual Broadway stage. I felt truly like I had made it.
Cody Costello was at one of those early performances. She's the president of Anchorage's Performing Arts Center, where real Broadway shows perform when they're in town. She was floored by the performance.
There's a certain type of quiet that will happen with an audience because they're so engaged. They're like on the edge of their seats. They're totally connected.
She invited the show to the Performing Arts Center. Actor Adela Judge says it's not a stage anyone expected to be on.
Feeling like we're so respected in the community just makes me feel like we've really done something amazing. Like we're unstoppable.
But then at the end of March, bad news. The Anchorage School District notified hundreds of teachers that they would lose their positions due to a massive budget deficit. Like was among them. He'll be transferred to another school. And because he's the only theater teacher at West High, that means an end to the current theater program. Adela Judge says the students are crushed.
I can't even imagine what it'd be like without having the arts and having theater be such a supportive, like, stake in the ground for me, like, keeping my tent from falling over.
School districts around the state have been urging lawmakers to increase the amount of money schools get. Last week, West High students started making those calls, too. But if that doesn't happen, Judge says maybe they can create a home for theater kids with an after-school club. They'll take the stage at the Anchorage Performing Arts Center on Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Floor in Anchorage.
Ain't no difference anymore. Way down, Hadestown, way down under the ground.
This is NPR News.
In Syria, the oppressive Assad regime is gone, but amid poverty and devastation after years of war, theft is now on the rise. So what do you do if you're a business owner or a shopkeeper? Local leaders in Aleppo are figuring it out.
We are trying to install lights all over Aleppo.
Citizen efforts to rebuild in Syria, that's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilsa Chang. The new documentary Pets celebrates the animals we love.
The relationship between humans and animals, it is a joy to navigate. And man, oh man, for me, it's been the stuff of life.
I speak with director Bryce Dallas Howard after today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. The Senate has confirmed President Trump's nominee to be the top U.S. military officer. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is Lieutenant General Dan Kane.
Kane is a retired F-16 pilot who was deputy commander of a task force in Iraq when then-President Trump met him in 2018. Trump has claimed that the general put on a Make America Great Again campaign hat during that visit. U.S. military officers are banned from engaging in political activity, and General Kane denied that story at his confirmation hearing. He promised to be apolitical as the nation's top military officer and said he would resign if asked to carry out illegal orders by the president. Unlike previous chairmen, Kane has never led a combatant command or military branch. He replaces General C.Q. Brown, who Trump fired 2 months ago. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has questioned if General Brown had been appointed simply because he is black. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The Pentagon has removed the commander of a U.S. space base in Greenland after she told staff in an email she did not agree with Vice President J.D. Vance's criticism of Denmark. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
In removing Colonel Susanna Myers, the Pentagon said in a statement it would not tolerate actions that undermine the chain of command or subvert President Trump's agenda. During a brief visit to the base last month, Vance charged that Denmark was not doing enough to protect Greenland, which is overseen by Denmark. Trump has said he wants the U.S. to take over Greenland. In her email, Myers said the views of the administration are not reflective of the base. The story was first reported by military.com. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
President Trump completed his annual physical exam today at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center outside of Washington. The president told reporters on Air Force One he expects the details to be released possibly on Sunday. This is NPR News. Movie stunt work will be honored at the Oscars starting in 2027. As NPR's Mandela Del Barco reports, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has announced the creation of a competitive award for stunt design.
For years, stunt performers lobbied to get their own category at the Oscars.
To the stunt performers.
Saluting them on stage at last year's Academy Awards was actor Ryan Gosling, who portrayed a stuntman in the 2024 movie The Fall Guy.
From the depths of space to the battlefields of Earth and beyond, stunt performers and the action they design continue to create some of the most memorable moments in the history of cinema.
Gosling reminded audiences that silent movie stars Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd did their own dramatic falls and near misses. Now the Academy says it will honor modern-day stunt coordinators for their on-screen work. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Three people died. One other person was hurt when a General Aviation twin-engine plane crashed today near the Boca Raton, Florida airport. Authorities say the plane may have had a mechanical problem and was attempting to return to the airport when it crashed after being airborne for about 20 minutes. Several roads near Interstate 95 were closed because of the crash. The NTSB is now at the scene. Stocks closed the week up about 600 points after an up-and-down week on markets. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. What do you think when I say James Bond, Mission Impossible, or Fast and Furious? You think action, right? Tom Cruise and Daniel Craig leaping from buildings or dangling in the air from helicopters, and lots of spectacular explosions and car crashes. Well, all of it, all of those stunts, they require careful and precise work to be successful and safe. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has just announced the creation of a new award for stunt design. So we called up longtime stunt coordinator and second unit director Jack Gill to talk all about it. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
I am well. So Jack, I know that you have been working in Hollywood as a stuntman for years and years, since the 1980s, and you have really been at the forefront of the effort of getting the Academy to recognize stunts. So just, what was your reaction when you heard that this was actually going to happen?
Well, I mean, I was screaming and yelling because I really thought it was going to be something that was hard to achieve, but I never thought it would take 34 years. When this happened, I was elated and my family was elated and I was getting a million phone calls. And it is something that should have happened a long time ago, but I'm glad that it's finally happening now.
I mean, just hearing you talk about it and seeing the response, this has been lauded as a huge win for stunt professionals. But why do you think it is so important for the Academy specifically to recognize all of the hard work that goes into creating and performing stunts?
Well, I think a lot of it is the fact that I don't think they realized before we started kind of training them and trying to say this is what we really do, that every single action piece you have to put together and protect people. And so you're creating a vision within what the director sees, and you also have to have a big look at safety because we do such extravagant stunts. So, you know, it is the action designer is something that has to come about. And I think in our world, the fact that they are finally saying, yes, let's give them an Oscar category and an award is something that we needed. We just want to be recognized by our peers. That is the biggest thing. And finally, the Academy has come around and they said, we want to be a big part of it. And I'm happy for it. I'm really, really elated.
And we should just note that this new category will be added to the 100th Academy Awards, which means that we won't see these awards until 2028. But I mean, as you point out, stunts have just had this long history in our movies. You think of folks like even Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. So why do you think it is that it's taken so long, frankly, for the Academy to keep up and catch up?
Well, because it's a long process, because you know, a new category is something that doesn't really happen often. They had a special effects category that was added onto, but creating new categories is something that takes a lot of paperwork. And I didn't really understand that, but that's the way that they understand, you know, the process of a stunt designer. We're not only doing storyboards, but we're designing the character around what his dialogue actually is. It's not just standing up there and saying, this guy's going to fall on his head or girl. It's much more, and I think the design of it is what really gives you an idea of what we do. It is a design process.
There's so much excitement from so many people about this category being introduced. So I just wonder, do you think that this will change the way that audiences perceive what stunt professionals like yourself do?
I don't think it will, because of social media. Everybody is aware that there is someone that creates all of this, and there are also stunt doubles for all of the actors. 30 years ago, people were afraid of saying, well, let everybody know that the actor does everything. But in today's world, that's just not what happens anymore. All actors want to come out and say, no, I'm not doing it. I've got three stunt doubles. So I think that part of it has gone by the wayside because of what people have access to.
That's Jack Gill, a veteran Hollywood stunt coordinator and second unit director. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
College can be a complicated time for students, but, you know, over the past few weeks, the mood on many campuses has grown dark as the Trump administration cracks down on pro-Palestinian activism. Some students have had visas revoked. There have also been several high-profile arrests. And as NPR's Elena Moore reports, it's left many students feeling silenced and fearful.
For more than 2 weeks last spring, Cornell University was home to a student encampment. Dozens slept in tents on the quad to protest Israel's war in Gaza. Sam, a PhD student on a visa, visited the encampment daily. She has to go by that nickname because she's fearful of how she might be treated by immigration authorities if targeted for deportation.
It's actually one of my most beautiful memories in Ithaca because the supportive and accepting and diverse environment that we had.
Cornell's encampment was part of a wave of demonstrations at schools around the country, calling on universities to divest from Israel. Students say these protests were largely peaceful, but they're now under new scrutiny as part of a policy the Trump administration says is aimed at eliminating anti-Semitism from American campuses. It's made Sam worried about her safety.
A huge part of my time that I used to dedicate to work, to my projects, to organizing, I've had to move it towards preventive actions.
Now, when she picks out her clothes each morning, Sam asks herself if they're comfortable enough to wear if she is arrested. Not being able to share her beliefs as openly as she used to upsets her.
I have to hide my name as if I was a criminal who has done, something that needs a cover-up. It makes me mad because this is who I am.
In the past few weeks, Sam has watched other student protesters like Mahmoud Khalil, a graduate student at Columbia University, targeted for deportation by the administration. Khalil was a legal permanent resident. Others like Tufts University PhD student Rumaysa Osterk was here on a visa. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has defended the arrests.
We are not going to be importing activists into the United States. They're here to study. They're here to go to class. They're not here to lead activist movements that are disruptive and undermine our universities.
Rubio has said he's revoked hundreds of visas, including many for students. The administration argues they engaged in anti-Semitic harassment or violence. And while some Jewish students did report feeling unsafe during the protests, students like Sam, who backed the demonstrations, dispute allegations of discrimination. They say the administration's actions are an attack on free speech that's had a chilling effect for some on campus.
We've seen a lot less attendance from international students. Even like some organizers, they had to quit because of just the amount of potential risk that's involved.
That's an undergraduate at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. He's a U.S. citizen but chose to speak anonymously. He's of Palestinian descent and worries about the ability to visit family abroad. He says the administration's crackdown has caused organizers to take more precautions when speaking out, like advising international students not to lead demonstrations.
We try to have our citizens always do the speeches, always be the ones that are planning it, because we have the least risk at the moment. So yeah, we definitely advise our international students to stay away for now.
Back at Cornell, undergraduate Yehoun Stitt is working to get more protections for non-citizen students. He recalled speaking with an international student who was afraid to speak out and watching her get emotional.
She said, "I felt like no one had cared about us." That is what they feel at this university. They feel like the university isn't here to protect them.
Students want more support from their institutions, but the schools are under pressure. The Trump administration has announced investigations into 60 schools over their handling of alleged anti-Semitism. And it's pulled federal funding, including from Cornell. Just this week, the administration froze a total of $1 billion slated for the university. Elena Moore, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Painter Amy Sherald had a retrospective open this week at New York's Whitney Museum of American Art. In 2018, she painted Michelle Obama's portrait, seated in a flowy white poplin dress, resting her chin on her hand. NPR's Olivia Hampton met Sherald at the Whitney and brings us this report.
The show is called American Sublime. For Amy Sherald, who came up with the title, it links back to her family roots in the South.
When I think of American Sublime, I think about my mother, who was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1935, and what she survived to become and live in the year 2025. So the beauty and the terror of what it was to be raised in the South.
Sherald paints black subjects using shades of gray for their skin tones, and it contrasts with her otherwise striking color palette. It lets viewers consider the subject's humanity before their race.
I think subconsciously I had a fear about my work solely being about identity and race, and I didn't want that. I think that was one of the important things that I thought about. It's like this work has to speak to not only people that look like me, but also sit in the world for all of us to understand.
Sherrold is subverting traditional narratives of who is American. There's a black couple standing proud in front of their car and yellow house, a transgender Statue of Liberty with bright pink hair, a brawny boxer without legs in a ring. The portraits look out at the viewer. They seem to have a rich interior life. Rujeko Hockley curated the Whitney's iteration of this traveling exhibit after its first stop in San Francisco.
It's really about kind of individuality, interiority, how we adorn ourselves, how we move through the world, and the kind of idiosyncrasies of everybody in the world.
Hockley points to a 10-foot canvas where two black men restaged the iconic World War II photo of a white male sailor kissing a white nurse in Times Square. In Sherrold's portrait, the men are both sailors kissing against the blue sky.
It's a very kind of quietly subversive but very impactful act to reimagine this image that people really have burned into their minds. This kiss is kind of one of the most iconic and well-known photographs of the 20th century, and just this tweak transforms it entirely.
Today, Sherrold's bright, bold portraits are owned by collectors like CNN's Anderson Cooper or sportscaster Bryant Gumbel. But her journey was a long one.
I was waking up and going to my studio at 8 o'clock in the morning and working until 3 p.m. and leaving my studio and then going to wait tables from 3 to 12. I was broke for a very long time, but I always believed in myself and believed in the work and knew I had something special. And so I always tell young artists, the world is full of quitters, so don't quit and you'll eventually rise to the top. And here I am, ta-da.
Sherrold's breakthrough didn't come until she was 45, when she painted Michelle Obama. That work was commissioned by the National Portrait Gallery, which is set to host the show in September. But it's part of the Smithsonian Institution, which President Trump has targeted in an executive order for being, quote, under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology.
We're talking about erasure every day, and so now I feel like every portrait that I make is a counter-terrorist attack. It's a counter some kind of attack on American history and on Black American history and on Black Americans.
The show is at the Whitney through August 10th. Olivia Hampton, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is downsizing federal agencies, it's ending federal grant programs, and it's dismantling diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. This is all affecting cultural groups across the country. NPR's Chloe Veltman brings us the story of one small community organization in California trying to make sense of the new chaotic funding landscape.
The Chinese Culture Center of San Francisco is an anchor in the city's vibrant Chinatown neighborhood. Since 1965, the nonprofit has offered art and education programs that serve the Asian diaspora through exhibitions, talks, and even dance flash mobs. Jenny Lung is the center's executive director. She says up to 30% of her organization's funding each year comes from federal sources.
We were extremely proud to be funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Institute of Museum Library Services.
But now Lung says she feels let down by all three agencies.
Creating a lot of different chaos.
The National Endowment for the Humanities canceled a grant last week worth over $115,000.
It just said the project wasn't aligned with the priorities and that it was terminated.
More than 1,000 such grants were cancelled in all 50 states. Lung says the funding was meant to document the neighborhood's rich history and culture. Cantonese-speaking photographer David Huang was part of the project. He says he's beyond disappointed to hear about the grant being cut. That's not the only funding challenge facing the center. Executive Director Jenny Lung says her team applies annually for National Endowment for the Arts grants, but they haven't this year because of the Trump administration's executive orders targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
There's all this fear of what, like, illegal DEI means, and trying to sort that out.
Lung says the center is also waiting for a final grant payout from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, reimbursing leadership training for culture workers. In March, the Trump administration put all of the agency's staff on leave and is not currently administering any grants. Documents shared with NPR shows the Chinese Culture Center is still owed nearly $30,000. Lung says she's submitted multiple payment requests.
Haven't been getting a response.
Lung says she's looking for ways to recoup the losses. San Francisco District 3 Supervisor Danny Sada oversees Chinatown. He says he wants to help.
As a lawmaker in San Francisco, I want to make sure that our organizations, especially organizations that I represent, get the money that they've been promised.
NPR reached out to the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Institute of Museum and Library Services for comment, but received no responses. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Pets can be like another member of the family. Well, at least that's the way it is in my house. There's no better feeling than when my dog runs to the door to greet me when I get home from a long day of work, or when he curls up next to me on the couch when I'm watching a movie. That is exactly how I watched a new documentary directed by Bryce Dallas Howard.
The relationship between humans and animals and that experience of cohabitating and the personalities and the mutual needs, it is a joy to navigate. And man, oh man, for me, it's been the stuff of life.
The film is called Pets, and I started off by asking her what pushed her to take her love of animals and make it the basis for a documentary.
There's a side of people that come out when they're talking about their pets that's very revealing and incredibly human. And so I pitched Pets to my producer, and he said, "Sounds bad for my allergies." And now, many years later, he has a dog that he's obsessed with. And he's totally a pet guy now.
Well, one of the things that's really remarkable is that this documentary includes pet owners from all over the world. I'd love to know more about one of those specific stories. Just to give folks an example, there's a man named Sterling Davis from Asheville, North Carolina, who is a rapper who also yes. rescues cats for a living. His beloved cat's name is Rick James. Can you tell us a bit about his story?
Yes, yes. So his kind of way into pet rescue was through his cat, who is no longer alive, but he, you know, he talks about him in past tense and was really, you know, his best friend. And he learned so much about cats and that kind of love, the depth of love. He grew up as a kid kind of in a, he's alluded to kind of not the most sort of like loving upbringing on the whole, but always would bond with animals.
I felt voiceless. I felt like I couldn't do anything. So you feel a little helpless, like you don't have nobody. I see the cats the same way.
he has an organization and he has a really robust Instagram, and he rescues cats and does a lot as well in the education space so that folks know the benefits of not just rescuing cats, but also spay and neutering, and why it's very important to just be responsible in terms of being a pet guardian.
This documentary really covers the whole range of what it means to be a pet guardian, that the love and the joy that our pets give us. And there's also, of course, the sad reality that in most cases, we outlive our pets and then we have to let them go. I'd love to hear you just talk about how you approached that part of our relationship with our pets.
Lifespan sucks.
Yeah.
That ratio really sucks, you know? That was something that was important for me to explore, but also to explore lightly. I didn't want to go anywhere that I wouldn't feel comfortable kind of talking about with a six-year-old. And what I found so fascinating was when I did actually talk to all the kids about pet loss, they were so wise.
An animal just loving you unconditionally makes a connection you just can't break.
You and I are both people who have had so many rich and rewarding relationships with animals throughout our lives, but I realize that not everybody's in that camp, and some people might think it's silly or basic to devote so much time to creating art about our pets. Is there a story or a conversation or a part of the documentary that you'd point to help them understand what these animals mean to so many of us?
When I was actually kind of coming up with this idea and trying to set it up, I learned that there are more people who have pets than have children.
Wow.
And that to me was really interesting because there's a lot more space for parenting and that conversation and all of that, and people who are really devoted to their pets. There is a perception, maybe, that gets a little much for some folks. And I think that's maybe the stigma that hopefully, in a way, if there is one, if there is one at all, that, you know, this movie, you see just the variety of relationships and the depth of those relationships, and that any sort of eccentricities that come with a person who is obsessed with their pets, you understand the love that is behind that. And empathize with, you know, with their humanity.
Bryce Dallas Howard is the director of Pets, which is streaming on Disney Plus. Bryce, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action, nature.org/NPR. From Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
Thank you.